Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman. Thank you all for listening. Today, we'll be talking to Judy Reaver about her book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, first published in 2018 by Random House Canada, with a paperback printing coming in February 2020, with some updated research. Based on my own concerns with the suppression of the UN mapping report, the lack of attention to and accountability for crimes committed by the RPF during the genocide in Rwanda, and the near invisibility of the millions of people killed in the DRC, I was very interested in reading your book, Judy, though I must admit I was not fully prepared for what I would read. With that said, Judy, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, like where you were born, where did you go to school, and things of that nature.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I am a freelance journalist. I was born in Montreal. I grew up south of the city in the countryside and later went to university in Ontario, where I got a degree in biology. I was first interested in genetics. Then I changed paths and went into journalism. I studied at Ryerson University in Toronto. In later years, I completed a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at the University of British Columbia.
It's a very interesting background. We'll get to, in a moment, how you became interested in Rwanda. But before doing so, doing the investigative journalism that you did for this book, really requires some great commitment and perseverance, mentally and physically, I'm sure. Do you have any mentors, peers, or someone who's inspired your work?
Well, the best course I ever took in journalism school was investigative journalism, and it was taught by an investigative journalist who worked for the Globe and Mail, Canada's most read newspaper. And this person, this investigative journalist, was a mentor for me. He taught me how to examine powerful interests that operated locally and globally, and he taught me, encouraged me and other students to look at Western governments and whose interests were being served by decisions and why. He primarily or initially, and then I later worked with some senior journalists at CBC Television. I was doing research on documentaries, and they reinforced this journalistic credo. And a number of them taught me, one in particular, who worked for the flagship investigative program, the Fifth Estate, taught me how to document my interviews and stories in highly detailed ways, create a chronology in order to fully understand events and people, and how to discover the inconsistencies and contradictions in chronology and in accounts. And so he helped me establish I watched how he created timelines and how he collected evidence in his interviews. And so all that taught me how to collate evidence, layer it, and see how evidence stands in a court of law. Because a lot of investigative journalists have to vet their work with lawyers. So these methods have guided and informed my work ever since. And I was taught some of these things at a very young age.
It's very interesting. I've been reading, just on my side reading, fictional work, some crime dramas, and it sounds like a lot of the same investigative techniques are used in crime investigations as you are for your journalism. So with that, I mean, you're welcome to comment on that if there's anything you want to add, but I also want to then understand how you became interested in Rwanda and the Great Lakes region.
Well, I always thought I would actually work on Latin America, but I ended up focusing on a different landscape entirely, which was Central Africa. Well, Africa in general. At first, I got a job at Radio France International in Paris, and editors put me immediately on the Africa desk. And that opportunity provided me with an infinite amount of learning and challenges. So, and I never looked back after that. It felt like it was the beginning of my education as a world citizen. And so I think once you start working on Africa, in my case anyhow, it just offers journalists like me who are interested in culture, human rights, history, and the relationship between the West and the global South, it offers those journalists the ultimate landscape. So that's how I really got into working on Africa.
So moving into the book from there, there are two intertwined stories in your book, one being your research into the impact of the violence on people in Rwanda and the DRC and the crimes committed by the RPF and RPA, and the other being how conducting this research impacted your life. I would like to begin with the former, but would be remiss if we didn't take some time to discuss the dangers you faced and the courage it took to ultimately bring your research to the public. So going back to the previous question about how you became interested in Africa and the Great Lakes region, how did you come to write this book? What motivated this particular study?
Well, the book is like a 20-year journey of how long it took me to research and examine RPF crimes. So it was a quest. I needed to understand the violence and the suffering I saw in Congo. And so I was very interested in the Great Lakes region already, having read a lot about the genocide, the Rwandan genocide. And after Rwanda invaded Zaire in 1996, I was working for Radio France International, which sent me to cover the toppling of Mobutu Sese Seko and to cover the humanitarian crisis. I'd never been to a conflict zone before, much less a war zone. So I was very green in that respect. I'd been taught to tell big stories by relating individual stories. I felt that the most compelling issue as soon as I got there, within days of Mobutu being toppled, was to examine the violence against Hutu refugees in the Congolese forests and the forced displacement of Congolese. So I wanted to understand how that violence, I quickly started to ask myself some fundamental questions when I got into the jungle and I started interviewing refugees. I don't know if you want to ask me a bit more about that.
Sure. What was that experience like? I actually have a former student who was doing some research into the refugee camps and how they were used as places that were, Hutu would congregate and then would be infiltrated and then violence would be perpetrated there. What did you learn from visiting these refugee camps?
Well, what I saw haunted me for years. I went in with local aid workers, Congolese aid workers, into areas of the jungle, principally south of Kisangani, which is in the northeast of Congo. And what we were looking for were surviving refugees, refugees who had suffered atrocities and were languishing in the jungle, but who had survived attacks by Kagame's army. And so I was able to witness firsthand the effects of the massacres that had been perpetrated against Hutu refugees by Kagame's Tutsi-led army. And I was able to see some of the suffering from 8 months of their trek through the forest, being chased by Kagame's rebels, Kagame's army. But in particular, what emerged from those interviews, which haunted me for years, was the anecdotal evidence which I gained from those interviews from the refugees themselves, who told me, you know, I asked them in particular why they had fled Rwanda in the first place and why they stayed in Zaire after the genocide, after Kagame had seized power and was establishing security post-genocide. And they shared their stories with me about how they had, anecdotally, how they had been attacked in Rwanda in 1994, and how they were, you know, after the genocide, afraid to go back because they thought they would be killed, and that many of the people who had gone back, I'm talking about Hutu refugees, had disappeared. And so this was astonishing to me. I'd never heard these stories. And there was, a lacuna in studies about why Hutus had fled Zaire in the first place and why they never went back, why they were reluctant. And so there wasn't this documentation. And so the official narrative did not make sense to me. And this is really the reason that I kept doing research.
Thank you. And in speaking with refugees, did any of them tend to sort of point blame at any institutional failures for their protection? Speaking of refugee camps, was this a United Nations failure? Was it a Congo failure, the international community? Was there any sense of, feeling like they were, you know, just left unprotected by the institutions that are supposed to protect refugees?
Well, there was a major breach of trust for the refugees by the United Nations, and certainly in particular the UNHCR, which was highly politicized and was forcing Hutu refugees to go back to a country led by killers. And so this was what loomed large in their mind. They did not want to go home. The UNHCR was forcing, you know, men, women, and children onto planes or in trucks and sending these people who had survived atrocious attacks in the Congolese jungle. And the UNHCR was telling them, you have to go back to Rwanda where it is safe. And so it was really, in many respects, a twilight zone because it made no sense. And it was clear that the UNHCR, in Hutu refugees' mind, did not have their best interests in mind and was not actually fulfilling their role, their mandate in protecting refugees. So that was number one, I think. The number two, there was always and there remains a lingering suspicion among Hutus in Rwanda and in exile that the international community does not believe them has, you know, believed the official narrative that in fact has demonized Hutus as an ethnic group. The lack of justice at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the way in which Hutu refugees were treated in the Congo and left to the devices and of Kagame and his Western backers, I think that has contributed to great disillusionment and suffering among the refugees.
You mentioned where the Hutus were located, in the jungles, and it reminds me of a story very early in your book. I wonder if you might tell our audience just a little bit about the sort of perilous pathways you had to travel in order to speak with the refugees. The story that I am recalling from early in the book is crossing a bridge that had missing planks, and there's a jeep going across. Could you tell the audience a little bit about what you went through to conduct your research?
Yes, that was an incredible experience. I had started some of these search and rescue missions with local aid workers from Red Cross, Médecins Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders, and a few other agencies. And we crossed the Congo River in Kisangani and then headed by vehicles, SUVs, 4x4s, into the south of Kisangani, along a railway line, until we had to leave those trucks go on foot into the dense jungle. And at one point, we had to continue our trek, and we were in contact by walkie-talkies with other aid workers who were in in the jungle, searching for refugees who had found some survivors. And at one point, we had to cross a dilapidated bridge, and we could not cross it with the truck, with the vehicle we were in. This is actually obviously before we had started walking, but these people I were with, they were used to going very deep into the forest and facing all these perils, which quite frankly were really scary for me. But they were, the driver was telling me, well, we have to get in and cross this bridge. And it was missing, big chunks of its planks. And he said, there's no problem. We just take the planks that are there, they're movable, and we just keep moving them ahead. And then we go slowly across the bridge. And I said, there's no way I'm crossing the bridge. We're going to go down, the whole vehicle's going to fall into the ravine. And so I put up some, resistance. And I said, there's absolutely no way. And the local aid workers, one in particular, who I called Niana, she worked, she helped me, and we became very good friends. She said, I'll go with you on foot along the side. And so we walked very, carefully from my standpoint, with great trepidation along the side. We crossed this bridge to get to the other side and get to where we needed to go, which was further down the railway. But, I watched behind me this vehicle cross this bridge, and it was extraordinary. And it symbolized to me how devastated already this country was in terms of infrastructure, but how determined local Congolese were to do the jobs they had. They were so committed, and also how you used how they were just so used to dealing with adversity that it was something that was part of daily life. And so I think that's what I took away. But my whole trip seemed to be very physically, emotionally, and psychologically demanding. I was a Western reporter, used to a certain level of comfort and privilege, and I was very young and had never been in a conflict zone before.
I wanted to get back to something you said earlier about there being a gap in the literature and the narrative. And there's been numerous journalistic accounts, as well as, you know, dozens and dozens of scholarly accounts and books, and even more journal articles. How would you compare your book or situate it with other journalistic accounts, like Linda Melvern's book of the role of the West in Rwanda, Jean Hatzfeld's on interviews with killers and survivors, Gorevitch's work? I asked this question in part, as I mentioned, because there's so much to consume about Rwanda. And then on top of that, there's documentaries like Ghosts of Rwanda and the Hollywood's telling of Hotel Rwanda, Samantha Power's Pulitzer Prize winning book, A Problem from Hell. But even when these works, it seems to me, have been critical of the RPF for the West, none of them really tell the story like you do in A Praise of Blood. So where does your book sort of fit? And maybe at this time, you could also summarize for the audience what the popular narrative is on Rwanda, and what your book, how your book challenges that.
Well, I'll start with the last part of your question first, maybe. The popular narrative, or the official narrative, is that of the Rwandan genocide, is that the Hutu government at the time and its hardliners conspired for years to exterminate the minority Tutsi, and that Hutu extremists around Habyarimana lit the match to carry out their genocidal plan, lit the match, I mean, ignited the genocide by killing their own president, and that after that, Hutu citizens, peasants, in a frenzy, zealously participated in killing their neighbors and obeyed orders. So there was this narrative that of a popular genocide, so in fact, my story and the complete story of the genocide is very much different, and my story is polar opposite to some of the works that you mentioned earlier. So just to get into that, or do you want me to talk about my story, you know, what my narrative is, or would you like me to address some of the other works that you've mentioned?
Maybe address some of the other works, and then that could lead you into the sort of retelling or the revised narrative.
Well, my book is really kind of the polar opposite of the works you've mentioned. I would say that the work of Melvern and Gorevitch, Linda Melvern and Philip Gorevitch, in particular, offer up the story of the genocide as a Manichaean tale, and they quite frankly take a page from the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF rhetoric, and official statements about the genocide. Gorevitch's work in particular has been very ideologically driven, and he's done quite a job, an astonishing job at demonizing Hutus, stripping them of their essential humanity. Linda Melvern is a friend to one of the most violent regimes in the world at the moment. In recent years, she's received a medal from Paul Kagame. She does one source stories. For example, she revealed the so-called confession of Jean Kambanda, who was the prime minister of the interim Hutu-led government during the genocide. And she, of course, brought that, revealed this in her book, without pointing out, of course, the psychological distress and torture that was exerted on him to deliver that confession, and not pointing out that his deposition, which contradicted his confession, was hidden by the tribunal. So I think the foundation of her work, and that of others who have focused on the something called the Akazu theory and the genocide conspiracy, has been slowly dismantled over the course of many years. And even people who worked at the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICTR, that's the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, say there wasn't enough evidence to bolster the claims of the central tenets of what she and others have revealed, the Akazu theory and the genocide theory. The Akazu theory is that there was a group of hardliners around Habyarimana who conspired for years to plan this genocide. And so Malvern is in particular to this day very active in targeting anyone who critically examines the RPF record. And she'll accuse people like myself of being a Hutu power supporter. So that's how I see their work, her work in particular. Samantha Power, well, she's for years sung the praises of Kagame. Actually, she's trumpeted claims that Kagame stopped the violence during the genocide and reconstructed Rwanda. She, while working in the Obama administration, at the UN, became more critical about him holding on to power, but she largely applauded his epic achievements. And so her main thesis is that, in her book, was that the U.S. knew that a genocide was underway but actively worked at the UN to prevent intervention. That's correct. She's correct about that. But she doesn't point out, and so there's a fair amount of obfuscation in her work, that Kagame and his RPF threatened the United Nations with violence if the UN peacekeeping force at the time, if it did not withdraw its troops and get out of his way. So she should have written about what the United Nations and Washington knew about what the RPF was doing, what Kagame was doing, the threats, and about those crimes, because there was sufficient documentation of those crimes, and she would have gotten access to some of those archives. And just, if we continue a little bit with some of the names that you mentioned, Jean Hatzfeld's work, which I no doubt think was sincere. I think his attempts, he sincerely tried to offer a detailed picture of victims, Tutsi victims, but also Hutus, and he wanted to look at why people kill. But unfortunately, I think that he and maybe others who have tried to do that embark on this kind of dubious experiment, because interviewing Hutu prisoners in Kagame's Rwanda who are under duress is obviously, almost an impossible task. How can we put stock in testimonials from people who seek protection or try to avoid censor or violence, or possibly try to derive benefit by testimony that would bolster the RPF narrative? So doing interviews in that kind of Orwellian state creates a lot of problems. And I think that there's a major fault line of Scott Strauss's work as well. He's an academic. He wrote The Order of Genocide. Very interesting book. And I quote his work in my book. I think there are a lot of problems with doing research in Rwanda and collecting testimony. So my work, stepping away from that, my work acknowledges the genocide against Tutsis. I do this in every chapter. It's not an examination of the violence against Tutsis, but it's a look at what the RPF did before, during, and after the genocide, and how the RPF fueled the violence against Tutsis and committed genocide against Hutus. So what I try to show is that the violence, the dynamic of that violence was very complex.
With that, could you talk about the crimes that you believe Kagame and the RPF are responsible for during the time leading up to, during, and post-genocide in Rwanda?
Yes, I can. Really, the crimes before the genocide by the RPF were serious violations of humanitarian law. And strictly speaking, they could be qualified as ethnic cleansing, because from 1990, after Kagame's army invaded from its base in Rwanda, they undertook a scorched earth campaign in the north, principally in a prefecture called Byumba. And they did so for 3 years prior to the genocide. During that time, they seized land and destroyed economic livelihood for 1 million Rwandans, who ended up being squeezed into horrific internal displacement camps. So the RPF killed Hutus in seizing their land. They destroyed crops, raped women in some cases, burned homes, and created to some extent a Tutsi land in the north. And by 1993, Kagame's army was killing any Hutu on site, according to a former senior RPF military official and founder, Alphonse Furuma. I quote him in my book. It's not just what he says. This has been confirmed by a number of other of former RPF soldiers and officers, and also by Hutus who were displaced and victimized in the north. So that's the context in which the genocide was unleashed, and that's before the genocide. So then in April 1994, there's overwhelming evidence the RPF shot down the plane that carried the Hutu president, and that was the match that ignited the genocide. And as soon as my book, really, the core of my book is really showing how the RPF launched. As soon as the president was assassinated, the RPF launched preemptive systematic attacks, not retaliatory, but preemptive attacks against Hutu civilians, targeting, as of April 6th, targeting Hutu community leaders and then peasants in the north as they moved down the eastern flank of the country. I show how the RPF committed genocide by destroying, in part, the Hutu ethnic group. And as the genocide against Tutsis wore on, the RPF seized most of the countries. The RPF continued to kill Tutsis, kill Hutus by their favorite tactic of luring these peasants to meetings and then killing them. And they intensified their extermination campaign by loading Hutus onto trucks and shipping them off to Akagera Park, where they were burned and turned into ashes. And so I think, and these were men, women, and children. So that's what happened in 1994. And after July 1994, the RPF continued to kill in more clandestine ways. They arbitrarily rounded up Hutus, calling them interahamwe, put them in jails, and handed Tutsi civilians, also handed Hutus over, assisting the RPF. Hutus were loaded onto trucks again and taken to parks. So as a whole, the Hutu ethnic group has been neutralized and has been partially destroyed. But of course, Rwandan Tutsis the interior Tutsis have been largely destroyed as well, and they were have been marginalized and suffered in this campaign.
To put the story together, you had numerous sources of information from informants and dissenters to people working in state government, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. How did you build trust with these individuals? How did they learn to trust you? How did you corroborate the information they provided?
Well, investigative journalism takes time. It took years. I developed trust slowly and painstakingly among Rwandan people, Congolese and initially Rwandan Hutus in Congo, but then over the years, Rwandan people in exile. So it's their voices I believe needed to be listened to. Hutus in particular have been gaslighted by Kagame's regime and to some extent by the international community. So you build trust one person at a time. And I was looking, obviously, for direct witnesses to crimes, people who had seen or been victimized themselves, and contextual witnesses. And I would, find people, spend hours and hours with them over a period of weeks and go back to them. And then they would suggest others, quite frankly. And so sometimes I'd cold call people. For a while, I had a website where I posted interviews and articles, and people contacted me out of the blue. But essentially, I began to get a reputation for being somebody people could trust. I would keep their stories. I wouldn't expose who they were. Eventually, many people realized their stories were safe with me, that I found a way to amplify their voices without identifying who they were, because they were scared of being targeted, even if they were living, for example, in Uganda, in Nakai Valley, in the refugee camps that are still there in Uganda, or even living in Belgium or in Canada. So there was this dynamic and that took me many years to establish, but I think ultimately it worked. And there was also, you mentioned the tribunal. Yes, I had to establish contacts with people who had worked there. That took me a long time. People who were investigators there. And I also contacted many lawyers, not only defense, but people who worked for the office of the prosecutor. And I think there's this, huge dark cloud that looms over the tribunal to this day. The tribunal wrapped up a few years ago, and now there's something called the residual mechanism that's just finishing up a few cases. But there's this long shadow over their careers and their conscience. And I think that many people, they might have been reluctant at first, but they wanted to talk. Those who had asked critical questions about the court's dysfunction and the court's the infiltration of the court by the Rwandan regime, the manipulation of witnesses, the false leads, the buried reports. So there's this kind of tremendous sense of adjustment and frustration there at how Kagame and Washington influenced the outcome of the ICTR. So that was part of it. But the real, I think, success of my work, or where I managed to break through, if you will, is when I was able to access former officers and soldiers who had fled Kagame's regime. They're the ones who brought me in and showed me what the violence was really like. I think Kagame has miscalculated the shame and the rage among some of these people who fled as soon as they could and had been forced to engage in crimes or witness these mass murders. And so there's that aspect. There's this kind of overlapping testimony that from the initial accounts from Hutu victims to some of the reports that were leaked to me by the International Criminal Tribunal, and some of the interviews with the investigators I did, which confirmed what many of the Hutus had said. And then finally, these former officers who then managed to say, yes, this is what happened, but gave me so much more detail than those first two sources. So this was kind of, it was extraordinary, and at the same time, you know, it validated the experience of victims, I think.
Did you gain any insights from your research, especially with your interactions with officials at the ICTR, for how Kagame and others in the RPF have been able to escape accountability, or how they've basically been able to operate with impunity?
Well, it was a pretty difficult political and, you know, political context, but also security context that the tribunal operated. So, okay, how was the evidence ignored? There was a lot of evidence against Kagame, but it was willfully ignored by senior officials of the United Nations and the U.S. So there was a cover-up. Just to give you an idea of the extent of that cover-up, during the genocide in May, there were bodies floating in Akagera River in eastern Rwanda. These were recorded, they were filmed and aired around the world as proof that a genocide against Tutsis was occurring or had occurred. And there were bodies dumped in that river and finally washing up along the shores of Lake Victoria in Uganda from late April onward. But from late April, in the zone where those bodies were being, were floating in the Akagera, the Rwanda Patriotic Front controlled that area in the east. And the UN, in May, the UN was receiving or issuing protection cables of the RPF slaughtering Hutu civilians in that area as those Hutu peasants were fleeing into Tanzania. Those reports were harrowing and detailed. So the UN officials on the ground and the powerful political insiders knew about these massacres, but they buried them. There were no investigations of these RPF killings, no public interviews with the Hutu refugees who had fled into Tanzania about their loss of being chased and their loved ones being killed. There were no prosecutions of these crimes at the ICTR, even though those crimes clearly fell within the mandate of the ICTR's temporal jurisdiction. So that's how some of that evidence was ignored. And NGOs and journalists who were in Rwanda at the time, they weren't on the battlefront and they were not present during those massacres, but afterwards they were escorted around Rwanda and they were escorted there in that area and by the RPF. And they were told that these corpses were Tutsis killed by Hutu extremists. Now, Tutsis were being killed all over Rwanda, that's for sure. And there were likely Tutsis killed in eastern Rwanda in early April. But in that area just described, by late April and by May and June and July, the victims in those areas, which were under RPF control, were Hutus. So, and there were tens of thousands of them. And there are other reports. I mean, in September, a refugee consultant named Robert Gersony and his team did quite a very good investigation in, unfortunately, only one third of Rwanda's communes of what happened. And he concluded in an oral briefing that the RPF had committed genocide by committing systematic massacres against Hutu civilians. And he did this, he tabled this report for the UN. Now, the UN proceeded to use damage control tactics and it buried it. Washington did not want the UN to release this publicly. So there's that aspect too. And this is September 1994. The ICTR was also given, I got access to this, extensive lists of 18,000 people, for example, who the RPF killed in Gitarama. That's in the West, after Kagame's troops seized that area. And this was tabled as evidence with the idea that this would be investigated and prosecuted, these crimes. 18,000 names, which I have in hundreds of a big document, hundreds of pages. That was never investigated. And so it's an incredible story, the miscarriage of justice. In my book, I look at how the U.S. war crimes ambassador at large, Pierre Prosper, did a deal with the RPF. He ensured that the UN special investigations, these are the people who were charged with investigating crimes of the RPF in a clandestine, secret way. He did a deal that allowed the UN to hand over its evidence of RPF crimes to the Rwandan government after the, in 2003. So in other words, they let the killers investigate and prosecute themselves. It was an illegal deal, a huge breach of trust. And it showed how the UN tribunal had become an instrument of injustice. So all that was just, this bolstered Kagame and allowed him to continue to destabilize Rwanda, but also the greater region in Central Africa, in Congo in particular, where millions of people have died. So I think that is the great tragedy, how the international community, the legacy of the international community, especially the ICTR.
Yeah, I mean, what you reveal, I'm sure, is unexpected by a lot of readers, and perhaps also unwelcome. And so I wanted to ask you, as we near the end of our time together, how has your research in Praise of Blood been received by others? You mentioned already that you repeatedly refer to the genocide of Tutsi in Rwanda. But I guess I just have a feeling that you have possibly been accused of denying the genocide and other forms of criticism. So how has your work been received by others, from politicians to civil society to scholars? How has it been criticized? And do you think it's succeeding in at least putting raising questions or putting a dent in the official narrative?
Well, I think my book has, at the very least, challenged the official narrative or exposed the fraud of the lies behind a good part of the official narrative. So a few people have said I've defeated the official narrative. Now, I'm not able to say whether that's true or not. There's been a sufficient amount of backlash and vitriol in social media directed at me by trolls and Kagame propagandists. There's been no official reaction from Kigali, and I suspect it's because, I mean, it's been 2 years that my book, almost 2 years that the book was released, and I suspect that they know that the evidence in it is very tight and can't be challenged. So therein lies the problem they face. There's been silence and some resistance among mainstream scholars because my work controverts theirs quite, or at least challenges theirs. And so I think for a number of people who are interested in protecting their careers, they're very uncomfortable with my work. Others, and well, there have been some who've called it political. And I I disagree fundamentally with the accusation that my work is political, because they don't if they level that charge, they don't really understand what my work is about. Because in fact, the interviews and accounts of stories that I've revealed is something that the Rwandan political opposition in exile doesn't want revealed. A good part of the people in exile do not want Kagame's crimes exposed, especially former people of the regime, people who were civilian cadres and officials of the RPF, because they're directly implicated. So my work challenges the politics and upsets the political opposition. I've had a lot of encouraging feedback as well from Tutsis and Hutus who are apolitical. They've come to me who have nothing to lose except, you know, many of them are fearful of being targeted. But they've told me that my book is the real complete story of what happened. There's been some critical acclaim for my work. I've won some literary awards, but those awards are not as important to me as anywhere near as the significant support I've gotten from Rwandans, Tutsis and Hutus, who are free to speak about the history they've lived.
You know, I know there's an updated version of the book coming out in paperback in February 2024. Those who have not read the book, or anyone who maybe read the hard copy, can you give them some insight into any of the new material in the paperback version?
Well, the paperback version is really just a slightly updated version. There are more substantive updates in the chapter on the attack, the plane attack that triggered the genocide. So there's some new material there. And throughout the book, there are updates. But it's mainly the same story. I think there's not much that will, you know, surprise anyone in the paperback. Although, you know, I've written a story recently that's on the internet after my paperback version went to press that provides new material on the dynamics of violence during the genocide. And that, of course, was released just a few weeks ago. It was an article I did for the French magazine Marianne, looking at how the RPF was involved in killing Tutsis in Western Rwanda in a place called Bisesero, where thousands of Tutsis were killed.
I know you talked a little bit about this when we started our discussion, but do you have any advice for others who are considering engaging in the type of investigative journalism that you undertake?
Be very careful. I think that's a hard one. I think that. This is, for people starting to look at this, I think the Rwandan issues and Congolese issues are almost like a political minefield. And there is a lot of, and you would be aware of this, Jeff, a lot of polarized opinion about history continuing crimes that are committed in Congo and Rwanda. So there's that. I do think, you know, there's an incredible amount of data mining. There's rich literature out there. I think it's always important as a journalist or as a scholar, as a student, or anyone just interested in these issues, human rights and history, to take a step back and forge your own opinion about this. But what I tell people, whether they're working on these issues or whether they're just trying to educate themselves, especially Westerners, but also Africans, is we need to really listen to the people who have fled. There's a country called Congo in the heart of Africa that in many ways has been hijacked by violence and is now, for many people who live it day to day, and I know this because I get updates daily from Congolese living there, there's a military occupation. There are criminals within the Congolese army, and the Rwandan military elements are active every day, wreaking havoc continuing to spread their violence and terror. So there's, in some ways, this, prison that they live in. Also, there's very much a mass surveillance state in Rwanda, there's violence that we never hear about. We hear about some of it, but for the most part, we don't hear about the daily struggle and the violence and terror that Rwandans live in. So it's very important that people, especially journalists and people who work in governments and in academia, listen to the voices of people who flee. That's not to say that work can't be done in Rwanda and research can't be done, but I think now there has to be intensified efforts to document in an empirical way the lives of people who have fled, these atrocities and who have lived through these experiences.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you so much. We've taken up a lot of your time, and so I do want to, let you go. But before I do so, is this what you're still working on, or are you working on something new that the audience can be watching for?
Well, I'm still working on this. In some ways, I feel like there are so many things we don't understand about violence in Central Africa, but also the history. As I said, I've directed some of my attention in the last 2 years, actually many, many months, intensively researching the violence against Tutsis, the RPF's role in that violence. Because there has been a lot of literature on the attacks in Hutu-controlled zones of Tutsis and what Tutsis suffered, and there's been a lot of evidence that has been tabled at the tribunal. But I'm looking at what we haven't examined before. And so there's a rich amount of material that is shocking. And I've gotten through to some of it, and it sort of illuminates a whole different part of the story. And so I'll continue to do that, but I don't know how much longer I'm going to work on it. I think this is going to be material that Rwandans themselves are going to take up, from what I hear. So, in a few years, I might be doing something completely different, but this is what I'm working on right now.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for the work you do. As again, the paperback comes out February 2020, in next month. And so thank you, Judy, and take care and good luck with your work.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate you reaching out.